May 20th. Yanks won, O's won, so the East remains the same. Lieber looked good, which is a worry. Contreras is iffy, so the Yanks still don't have a real number five guy. But if Brown and Vasquez and Lieber throw as well as they have, they'll stick around. At some point, the O's hitters are going to fall into a slump, and their pitching won't carry them. More injury woes. Williamson, who's been complaining of soreness in his elbow for a few weeks, finally gets it checked out. Bill Miller's knee was hurting him again last night, so he's flown back to Boston for an MRI. And Manny's at DH again because of a tender groin. This is turning into the photo negative of last year when everybody was healthy.
The Sox won last night, and so out on the left coast did the Yankees. So Boston maintains its half-game finger hold on the top spot. It's far too early to worry about who's in first, although never too early to worry about who's on first. But it's important to keep pace, and so far we're doing that. I stand by my belief, or maybe it's an intuition, that the wildcard team won't come out of the AL East this year. But if the race were over today, the Yankees would be that team, beating the White Sox in the Central Division for the spot by a mere half a game. Anaheim, the team the Yankees beat last night and won the Sox have yet to play, has the best record in baseball at 26-13. The Red Sox, not far behind at 24-16, have cobbled together a winning team, and perhaps just as important, a winning chemistry, out of what amounts to spare parts. And I have to wonder what happens when Trout and Nomar come back. In last night's pregame show, Theo Epstein said they were both getting close. The question isn't whether or not they're good enough to play for the Red Sox. That's a no-brainer. The real question is how quickly they can get up to speed and who goes where once they do. I think that the original plan was for Pokey Reese to play second and Mark Bellhorn to ride the bench. But Bellhorn has been clutch for the Sox during the first 7 weeks of the season. Not spectacular like Manny Ramirez, who's currently batting something like 1 point for every day of the year, but clutch just the same. So who rides the pine when Nomar comes back? Probably it will be Bellhorn, but I hate to lose his bat and his discerning eye at the plate. And while I won't miss Kevin Millar a bit in right field, he made another one of those absurd shoestring attempts last night during Schilling's rocky first inning. I am anxious about how quickly Trout and Nomar can ramp up their bats. No matter. On to the important stuff. Baseball is a great game because you can multitask in so many ways and never miss a single pitch. I find I can read 2 pages of a book during each commercial break, for instance, which adds up to 4 an inning, more if there's a pitching change. Thus, it's sometimes possible to read as many as 40 pages a game, although it's usually less because there are always bathroom breaks and fridge runs. Then there's the face game. I play this by keeping an eye on the faces of the spectators behind home plate. Some nights, I'll run a 10-point nose-picking competition, which can be played solitaire or with a friend. You get the odd innings, your friend the even ones. 10 is a good number to play to in this game, I've found. But when playing cell phone, you have to play to at least 21, because these days almost everyone has one of those annoying little puppies. Hi, hon, I'm at the ballpark. What? Oh, not much. Rays are down by 3. I hear people whispering dead team walking under their breath. It's a little spooky. Bring home a quart of milk? Sure, okay, call you later. Gotta pick my nose on national TV first. Okay, love you too. Bye. And last night, remember, I never lost the thread of the game during this. That's the beauty of baseball. I had this wonderful idea for a story. What if a guy watches a lot of baseball games on TV, maybe because he's a shut-in or an invalid, or maybe because he's doing a book on the subject, poor schmuck, and one night he sees his best friend from childhood, who was killed in a car crash, sitting in one of the seats behind the backstop. Yow! And the kid is still 10! He never claps or cheers, never picks his nose or talks on his cell phone for that matter, just sits there and watches the game. Or maybe he's watching the main character of the story right through the TV. After that, the protagonist sees him every night at every game, sometimes at Fenway, sometimes at Camden Yards, sometimes at the Creepy Dome up in Toronto. But every time, there are more people the poor, freaked-out guy knew sitting all around him. This guy's dead friends and relatives, all sitting in the background at the ballpark. I could call the story spectators. I think it's a very nasty little idea. Meanwhile, Derek Lowe goes for us tonight. And here is an interesting little factoid. The hapless Devil Rays are almost 40 games into the baseball season and haven't yet won 2 games in a row. Lou Piniella must be finished with his liver and thinking of moving on to his kidneys. It's a shame, but we've got a job to do here, and hopefully D'Lo will do his part.
For the final game in Tampa, it's Lowe versus Victor Zambrano. A decent matchup, at least until they take the mound. Zambrano has a weird first, alternately walking and striking out hitters, finally getting Tech looking to leave the bases loaded. Lowe responds by giving up a single through the middle to former option QB Carl Crawford, then letting him steal second and third. With one out, the infield's back, and another grounder scores him. Both pitchers settle down in the second, but in the third, with one down, Lowe gives up a single to Brooke Fordyce. Then on 0-2, he leaves a pitch up to Crawford, who doubles down the line. With the infield in, Baldelli bounces one through the middle, 3-0 Tampa Bay. Huff nearly skulls Lowe with a line single. Then Tino singles on a pitch above the waist, 4-0. Dave Wallace visits, meaning we're going to leave him in. It's a mistake. Jose Cruz Jr., who's hitting under 200, doubles to left center. 6-0. Lenny DiNardo is warming, but Francona can't get him in quick enough, as little Julio Lugo takes Lowe off the wall and left for the 7th straight hit. 7-0 D-Rays. And that's it for D-Lo. Zambrano follows with his own nightmare inning, loading the bases with nobody out and giving up 3 runs. In the 5th, Tech puts one on a catwalk, and Johnny doubles in 2 more. That's as close as we get. Timlin and Jamie Brown conspire to give up 2 runs, putting it out of reach. The D-Rays pitchers walk 10, but they also struck out 15, including Manny 4 times, while the only pitcher of ours who had any success was DiNardo. A complete mess, canceling out Schilling's easy win last night. A bigger worry, Lowe, supposedly the best number 3 starter in baseball, hasn't won this month. May 21st. It's the revenge of the header. Messina leads Yanks past Angels, 6-2. We lose ugly to a last-place club, while they beat the team with the best record in baseball, and on top of that beat their ace, Cologne. At least the O's lost, otherwise it would be a total wipeout. I'm trying to be optimistic and look ahead, but tonight it's Arroyo versus Halladay. Our travel day knocked the 2 rotations out of sync, so Pedro's facing the lefty Lilly tomorrow. On Sunday, the game will be at, we get the far less interesting Wake versus Miguel Batista. We need 2 out of 3 from these guys, but right now the pitching matchups are in Toronto's favor. Halladay's stronger than Arroyo, and we have trouble against lefties, and historically don't give Pedro much run support. Wake Batista is a toss-up. Maybe it's just last night's game that's bothering me. If Arroyo can match Halladay and get us to their pen, we should win. And Pedro's flat-out better than Lilly. Batista's ERA is around 5, and like Zambrano, he walks a lot of batters. If we hit and Wake has the knuckler fluttering, we could sweep. The off-field news is that Johnny's shaving his beard for a literacy program at the Boston Public Library. Gillette's sponsoring the event to kick off their new line of razors. A crowd gathers on the plaza by the Prudential Center to watch some hot models lather him up. He sits still while they take the blades to his face, but in the end he finishes the tricky spots himself. He looks younger, baby-faced, and with his long mane he's got the Elvis as Indian Brave thing going on.
D'Lo was D-Redful. But tonight the Red Sox are back at the Fens, and for the first time this year I'm in the house. It's a beautiful night for baseball, too. 69 degrees at game time. Ray Sliman, who works for Commonwealth Limousine and has been driving me and my family to Red Sox games ever since the kids were small, is usually an optimist about Boston's chances. So I'm surprised, no, I'm shocked, to find him sounding downbeat tonight, even though last night's loss, coupled with the Yankees' win on the West Coast, has left us only half a game out of first. It makes me uneasy, too. Partly because Ray's in the car all day and listens to all the radio sports shows, discounting the crazies who call in as a matter of course. Thus, he's hip to all the current gossip. Mostly because Ray's one smart cookie. It's from Ray that I first hear the idea that Nomar should be back right now and DHing. It's also from Ray that I hear a lot of fans are beginning to lose patience with Nomar. Once the season begins, Major League Baseball quickly becomes a game of what have you done for me lately? And in Boston, cries of play him or trade him are beginning to be heard. Coming into the ballpark, lots of folks tell me hi. Most call me Steve. One woman tells her boyfriend, look, there's Steven Spielberg. This is more common than you might think, and I sometimes wonder if people point at the famous director and tell each other that it's Stephen King. The guy selling programs just outside Gate A pauses just long enough in his spiel to ask me how I'm feeling. I tell him I'm feeling fine. He says, do you thank God? I tell him, every day. He says, right on, brother, and goes back to telling people how much they need a program, how much they need a scorecard. Just $2 unless you're a Yankee fan, then you pay $4. Do you thank God? Every day. Yes, indeed I do. I'm blessed to be alive at all and have the sense to know it. It's especially easy to give thanks walking into Fenway Park under my own power on a beautiful spring night in May. We're inside the TV, I once heard a wondering child say after getting his first look at all that green. I'm still considering the novel idea of Nomar Garciaparra as the designated hitter when a woman cardiologist throws out the first pitch. She may be a hell of a doc, but she still throws like a girl. We all give her a big hand, and we give the Red Sox a bigger one when they hit the field in their fine white home uniforms. I feel the same thrill I did when I saw them go out there for the first time, at the age of 11 or 12, on an afternoon when the Tigers were their opponents, and Al Kaline was still playing for them, and my arms prickle when John Fogerty starts singing Center Field over the PA. They prickle again at the end, when the Red Sox put away the Jays 11-5, and the crowd starts out with the Standell singing Dirty Water. Every ballpark has its eccentricities. One of my Fenway faves, many fans hate it, is the late-inning playing of Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline. I have no idea when this started or why fans took it to their hearts. It's such a forgettable song. But there you are. It's just a Fenway thing, like the wave. Footnote. There was a time when you could see the wave going around at almost all baseball parks and football stadiums. To my knowledge, only at Fenway does it survive. Survive? Nay, sir or madam, it thrives. Tonight, it went around and around in the eighth, when the Sox sent 11 men to the dish and scored 6 times. I myself refuse to wave unless I am also allowed to scream Sieg Heil at the top of my lungs. The first notes of this song cause great excitement. When Neil sings Sweet Caroline in the chorus, 30,000 people respond at once and with no apparent prompting. Whoa, ho, ho, at the top of their voices. And when he adds, good times never seemed so good, the crowd responds, so good, so good, so good. How do these things get started? There's simply no telling, but such things, which occur when the TV-watching world is stuck with yet another Meet Me at Foxwoods jingle, are very much a part of not just the ballpark experience, but your ballpark experience, what makes home home. Man, I had a great time tonight. Manny Ramirez hit a moonshot. Mike, the hardest-working man in showbiz, Timlin, got the win. And I was there to see it all with my friend Ray. Oh, and Kevin Youkilis, a.k.a. the Greek god of walks, was up to his old tricks. In the bottom of the second inning, after getting behind 0-2, he fouled off a bunch of pitches from Roy Halladay, last year's Cy Young winner, and finally worked a walk. He scored. Later in the eighth, he walked and scored again. It's an OBPC thing. On-base percentage. May 22nd. When they don't announce the game-time temperature at Fenway, you know you're in trouble. And tonight they didn't. It was overcast and raw at 7:05 p.m. when the game started. Raw and downright cold when it ended at about 10 past 10. Footnote, 48 degrees according to Channel 4 weather when I got back to my hotel. I still haven't warmed up. At 10:45, I'm typing this with hands that feel like clubs, tingly clubs. Still, it's all good. We won. The Yankees lost down in Texas. And all at once, there's a tiny bit of daylight, a game and a half between us and second place. Ted Lilly pitched extremely well for the Blue Jays tonight and had a 2-run lead going into the sixth inning. That was when Manny Ramirez launched his second home run in the last two games over the left field wall and into the night. It's the big dinger that'll get the ink in the newspapers tomorrow, but the key hit of the inning, and probably the key to the whole game, was Mark Bellhorn's infield single in the sixth, which caromed off Lilly's shin, hurried him from the game, and thus got us into Toronto's less-than-reliable bullpen. Without Bellhorn on first, no chance for Manny to tie things up. QED. And an inning later, Euclis, the rookie with the big on-base average reputation, led off with a single and scored what proved to be the winning run. Keith Falk was once more lights out in the ninth, 9 saves and 9 opportunities. And I'm 2-for-2 this year at Fenway Park. And my hands are finally starting to warm up. See? It's all good.
May 23rd. It's Vermont Day at Fenway, and we're the first ones in Gate E. Last time out, I was discouraged by my net play, and the usher in Section 163 told me not to give up. He's glad to see me back, and I'm glad for the support. Steph thinks I'm nuts. We get the good spot on the corner, but there's a portable screen set up at third base so only a hooking liner can reach us. And the security guy says I can't go after any balls in fair territory, a rule which seems arbitrary to me. The only balls I'll have a shot at will be liners that bounce off the monster and back along the wall, and about 10 minutes in, that's exactly what Nomar hits. The ball rolls to a stop 20 feet behind us. No one can reach it from the high wall there, but I should be able to drag it closer and scoop it. I climb over the seats and section dividers until I'm in position above it. I can't quite reach it and stretch as far as I can with one hand, just nudging and then covering the ball, and drop the net. It lies 10 feet below me across the foul line. What an idiot. Steph, I'm sure, is pretending he doesn't know me. I figure the security guy will come out and confiscate it. At best, he'll give me a lecture. Gabe Kapler's witnessed my embarrassment and saunters over, shaking his head. I think he's going to take the ball from under the net and toss it to someone more deserving to teach me a lesson. But he throws it right to me. Then he takes the net and jogs back out to left with it. He could have used it last night, someone says. For a while, Gabe keeps his glove on and holds the net with one hand. But then he says the hell with it and tosses the glove. Manny and Nomar are up, spraying the ball around. When a Manny liner bounces to the side of him, he stabs at it and misses cleanly. See, it's not as easy as it looks. After about 5 minutes of just standing there with the net, he brings it back over. I get a picture of him, proof for Trudy. Another guy comes by and asks if that was me he saw on the monster a few weeks ago, and I find that I like this minor celebrity. Steph says a Sox photographer just took a picture of me. We're also visited by Chip Ainsworth, the reporter who interviewed me the first time I brought the net. He says we should see a game together from the press box. I worry a little about that blurry line between journalist and fan, but then I think, man, the press box. Steve arrives in his Yankees hater cap, and I go over to hang out with him and Steph. On the end pages of the John Sanford novel he's reading, he's scored the last two games. It's been a while, and we fall to talking, interrupted from time to time by folks who want to take a picture of him. We're sitting there discussing Manny's hot streak and Wake's last few starts when one of the Sox comes out and signs along the wall two sections down. From the inch-high brush cut, it can only be Tech. It's his day off, with Mirabelli catching wake. I excuse myself and climb over the section dividers and then wait in the crush. Go ahead and take the sweet spot, I tell him. It's all yours. Tech's signature is neat and readable. Thanks to eBay, I've seen it dozens of times, both authentic versions and fakes. He never finishes the final kick of the K, so it reads J. Varitel, number 33. On the pearl, it looks super clean, and I thank him and carry it by the seams like some weird breaking ball, making sure not to smudge the ink. I got a shot of you, Steph says. Yeah, Steve says. We got a picture of you pushing those little kids out of the way. Hey, they were pushing me. Wake looks good in the first, striking out his first two batters. Batista looks awful, walking Johnny on four pitches around his ankles. Orlando Hudson doesn't help him, booting Bellhorn's easy grounder. And David Ortiz scorches a ground rule double into the seats just past the pesky pole. 1-0 Sox. Manny Kay's chasing a 3-2 pitch. Dauber walks. Then Millar walks in a run. Batista's thrown 25 pitches, only 7 for strikes. After Euclid strikes out, Mirabelli comes up with bases loaded and fouls one behind him, high off the facade of the 406 club. Last year, a ball hit in that same spot ricocheted off the glass at an angle and landed in the row behind us. I turn, keeping my eye on it, and here it comes right at me. Steph thinks I think this about every ball. The sun is blinding and I'm not wearing shades, so all I see as it falls is a tiny black dot surrounded by white light. It's going to be just short, and I reach above everyone. I feel it hit, then feel nothing, and I think it's gone, that I've missed it. Then look down, and there it is in my glove. Maybe because it's the first inning, or because it was a crazy angle, or because the bases are loaded and we're up 2 runs, but the crowd goes nuts. I hold my glove up and take in the applause, unexpected and exhilarating, and slap hands with Steph and Steve. When I sit down, my heart's pounding, and I'm shivery inside my skin. I thought I'd missed it, so it's a guilty thrill. A freak accomplishment I doubt even now. I don't have time to think about it, because Mirabelli fouls off the next pitch the exact same way, caroming off the same pane of glass and dropping 2 rows behind Steve. I'm up and ready in case it bounces my way, but it's smothered and picked up. Batista gets Mirabelli and gets out of it. In the second, he has to strike out Dauber to leave them loaded again. This guy's terrible, I say. We should be up at least 4-0. We're not hitting with men on, Steve complains, and Mason, a neighbor in the front row, shows us a 30-page stat sheet that has the season completely broken down. So far, with the bases loaded, we've hit 2 doubles and 12 singles. Johnny and Pokey have the doubles. Johnny and Pokey also have the most hits with bases loaded, 3 each. Kapler and Bill Miller are 0-4. Ortiz, Dauber, and Crespo 0-3. Wake throws an easy third, and we finally cash in on Batista, scoring 4. Ortiz has the big hit, a 2-out, 2-run double, making him 3-for-3 with 3 RBIs. It's 6-0. And Batista's thrown 90 pitches. Now that Wake has a big lead, he gets sloppy, loading the bases with no outs and going 3-0 on Delgado. Delgado singles, bringing in 2, before Timmy gets a double play ball from Phelps and a first pitch flyout from Hinsky. A sudden roar and wave of applause from the third base side. It's someone famous climbing the stairs between 2 grandstand sections. Because it's Vermont Day, I think maybe it's Fisk, a Vermont native. But the tall, gray-haired man surrounded by so much security that I know without even seeing his face that it's John Kerry. As if to prove his loyalty, he's wearing a Sox warm-up jacket. Later, when he comes back from the concession stand, I see he's in the second row, and I think, our seats are better. We pick up another run in the 7th to make it 7-2, and Timlin and Embry close it with little difficulty. But 2 things happen that are worth noting. In the 8th, Cesar Crespo, who's turned 3 double plays today and missed a 4th only because Bellhorn's throw pulled Ortiz off the bag, makes an error and is loudly booed. Then in the 9th, when Francona puts in the hands team and Pokey's name is announced, the crowd gives him a sustained ovation. It's taken Pokey 3 years to get here, but now that he is, he's a favorite. Even among skeptics like Steph and Steve and myself. Whenever a ball skips through the middle or drops in short center, we say, Pokey would have had it. We win. But on the out-of-town scoreboard, the Yanks are up 7-3 on the Rangers. In the car, it's a final, 8-3 Yanks. So we're still only a game and a half up. When we get home, I find out that Bill Miller wasn't even there today. He was out in Arizona getting a second opinion on his knee. Regardless of the result, it's bad news. Euclid better take some extra grounders.
My third straight game at Fenway and my third straight win. I'm starting to feel like if I'd been here from the start of the season, we'd be 10 games in first. God will get me for saying that. Stewart came with his son, Steph, both of them equipped with gloves. Doug Mirabelli banged a foul off the glass facing of the 406 club in the first inning. Stu turned, stretched, and caught it neatly just as the sun came out. The crowd up the first baseline gave him a spirited ovation. Stu had class enough and wit enough to tip his cap. It was a nice moment, and I'm glad his son was there to see it. So Wakefield gets the win, the Red Sox sweep the Blue Jays, and our bullpen was pretty much untouchable throughout. Kevin Youkilis, glad you asked. The Greek god of walks reached base three times, one fielder's choice, two bases on balls, and scored once.
May 24th. Seems like we always have a day off just when we're getting hot. It gives me time to prepare for tomorrow's first meeting with Oakland since last year's division series, bound to be loud. It's a sweet matchup. Schilling versus Tim Hudson, who's 5-1 with a 2.90 ERA. It's Falk's first game against his old club and Terry Francona's. And of course, Scott Hatterberg will get a couple of hits and maybe Johnny Damon. Mark Bellhorn was also an A once, though a low-profile one. With all the turnover lately and Dan Duquette's endless fire sale of our best prospects, it's hard to find a club that doesn't have some Sox connection. Tonight's the Nomar Bowl in Malden, where dozens of Boston sports celebrities and their fans get together at Town Lanes and roll a couple of strings for charity. My friend Paul's wife Lisa is taking some balls for Nomi to sign, and one of them's for me. May 25th. It's 80 degrees in Hartford. In Boston, it's 50. I thought I'd be warm enough in a corduroy shirt, but I'm not. Waiting with me outside Gate E is a guy with a giant black wig. I think he's one of Damon's disciples, but it's a manny-as-buckwheat wig, a wild, lopsided fro. He and a friend are sitting on the monster. Tomorrow, they're in the 406 Club. They shelled out for the very tickets I'd seen on eBay and seriously contemplated buying, just because I'd never sat there. The 406 Club has rules. No jeans, and you have to bring a credit card to buy drinks. There's a free buffet. During the standard tour of Fenway, the guide says when they finished construction, they realized that because of the thickness of the glass, the room is virtually soundproof. They had to install speakers so customers could hear the game. Any other day, I'd say the 406 Club is no place to watch the Sox. But tonight, the idea of being inside is tempting. The gates roll open, and I hoof it down to the corner and left. I nab a couple of balls in BP and report my haul to my favorite usher, Bob, then stop by Autograph Alley to see who's signing. It's Rich Gale, a pitcher who was with us briefly in 84, then came back to coach in the early 90s. I remember that he pitched in Japan and ask him to sign his picture with Ganbatte. You mean Ganbatte Mas, he says. It turns out he pitched for the Hanshin Tigers, the Red Sox of Japan. That's right. And I was there in 85, the first year we won it. That must have been pretty wild. Oh, yeah, he says, and stops writing, as if he hasn't thought of that time in a while. And his expression is both ecstatic and guilty, as if he's recalling infinite, ultimate pleasures. I have him add Hanshin Tigers, 85-86, and leave him with a loud Ganbatte. Over at the seats, Steve's reading a suspense novel. Our neighbor, Mason, delivers the bad news. Bill Miller's having arthroscopic knee surgery and will be out at least 6 weeks. It's another blow, but Euclid has done such a good job offensively that there's no panic. If Nomar gets back soon, we can put Pokey at second as planned, slide Bellhorn over to third, and still have a solid backup. Again, we're all thinking of that magical day when Trot and Nomar come back, when right now we're playing fine without them. Temperature at game time, Carl Bean announces, 48 degrees. It makes me think of spring training, and how happy those Minnesotans were to escape their weather. Here, we're proud of it. 48? It'll get down to 42 by game's end. Tack on the wind chill, and we're talking mid-30s.
It's overcast and very chilly tonight. Shit, call a spade a spade, it's cold. My colleague, Stuart Onan, is undaunted. He shows up apple-cheeked and grinning, toting a bag of scuffed balls he shagged in BP. Proudest acquisition? A David Ortiz SWAT. The Weston High School chorus, all 9,000 of them apparently, lines the first and third bass lines to sing the national anthem. And the sound, which comes bouncing back from the green monster in perfect echoes that double each line, is spooky and wonderful. Stuart, meanwhile, is off trying to give Gabe Kapler a photo of Kapler holding Stu's custom fly shagging net, which some wits might argue Kapler could put to good use during his tours of duty in right field. The Red Sox, who will go on to romp in this one, put up just a single run in the bottom of the first. Not much, considering that they once again send seven men to the plate. The Sox stats this year with bases loaded and two out are pretty paralyzing. Just 12 for 54. Only two of those for extra bases, both doubles. All the rest mere singles. This time, Kevin, cowboy up Millar, is the goat, grounding weakly to first. He leaves two more on base in the third and leaves them loaded again in the fourth. The Sox score three that frame, but Millar has stranded eight men all by himself, and the game isn't half over. I bet his agent won't be bringing that stat up at contract time. Even without Millar doing much, anything really, it's 9-1 after five. Tim Hudson's gone, Oakland's baked, and I'm on my way to my fourth straight Fenway win. Mark Bellhorn gets five RBIs, Manny Ramirez hits another home run, and Kevin Youkilis reaches base four times in five at-bats, scoring twice. There are lots of things to like about this game in spite of the cold, but maybe the best, there's this little kid, okay, 10, maybe 12 years old, and late in the game, after a lot of people have taken off, he grabs one of the front row seats and I spot him and Stuart deep in conversation, cap visor to cap visor. They don't know each other from Adam, and there's got to be 30 years between them, but baseball has turned them into instant old cronies. Anyone looking over their way would take them for father and son. And what's wrong with that?
May 26th. Two number fives on the downward slide. Mr. Kim returns to Korea for unspecified treatment of his back and hip, while the Yankees give Donovan Osborne his outright release. It's late May, and the Yankees haven't figured out their rotation. Having Bronson Arroyo definitely gives us the edge. Tonight, it's the struggling Derek Lowe against Mark Redman, 3-2 with a 3.60 ERA. By comparison, Lowe's ERA is 6.02. We have Steph's sax recital and then dinner after, and get back in the A's fifth. It's 6-2 Sox with two down and no one on. I figure Lowe must be throwing okay. Kotze doubles. Burns singles him in. Chavez homers off the wall behind section 34, and it's 6-5. I wonder if it's me, if I should turn the TV off and come back later. I'm glad I don't. In our sixth, Johnny's on third with one down. Ortiz can't deliver him, and with two down and first open, Maka has Redman walk Manny. At this point, Redman's thrown 120 pitches. The switch-hitting tech is coming up, so with his relievers up and warm, Maka can choose which side of the plate he hits from. He lets Redman pitch to him. Tech hits one onto Lansdowne Street, and we've got a four-run cushion again. Anastasio Martinez relieves low, giving up three straight hits and a run before Embry comes on and gets out of it with a double play ball. In the A's eighth, they have two on and one out when Billy McMillan stings one down the first baseline. McCarty gloves it behind the bag in foul territory. His momentum takes him halfway to the tarp before he spins and throws to Timlin covering. McMillan slides and gets tangled up with Timlin. He's out. The replay's crazy. I've never seen anyone make that play so far in foul ground, and perfectly. That's exactly why McCarty's on the team. It makes me wish I could send him back to 1986 to spell Billy Buck for an inning. In the ninth, McCarty shines again, with a sweeping snatch of a bounce throw by Bellhorn, helping Falk to a 1-2-3 inning for his 10th straight save. On the post-game show, Eck tries to figure out Lowe's problem. Of the fifth, Eck says, "It's a mystical inning, and we crack up." Groovy Eck with his Farrah Fawcett wings. But he's right, too. Right on, Eck. When you win a game and your ERA goes up, you know you didn't pitch too good.
May 27th, 9 a.m. Neither Stu nor I made it to the ball yard last night. I had a Penn dinner in Boston's Back Bay, and Stuart had his son's saxophone recital, which he assured me is non-negotiable. The Red Sox did not miss us. Derek Lowe was once more far from perfect, but the Sox bat stayed hot, and in his start against Oakland, Lowe was just good enough to go six and eke out the win. The Red Sox rolled to their fifth straight, their seventh in their last eight games. But I watched Sports Desk this morning musing on my Yankees essay, the one where I talked about how we hate what we fear, and looking at my new hat, which was sent to me from YankeesHater.com, because the Yankees have also been winning, and while we've been doing it at home, they've been doing it on the road, which is a tougher proposition. They came from behind last night at Camden Yards, not just once but twice, finally putting the Orioles away 12-9. So in spite of this nifty streak of ours, we're still only a game and a half in front. Two Sox losses combined with just two Yankee wins, and we're back in second place. This is what the Yankees do. They hang around. Those suckers lurk. 10:30 p.m. The summer's disaster movie, The Day After Tomorrow, opens this weekend. But disaster struck tonight at Fenway Park, as Boston's brave little five-game winning streak went bye-bye in a big way. Oakland beat the Red Sox like a drum, pounding out 17 hits on their way to a 15-2 win. Me? I knew it was going to happen. I went to the game with my nephew John, who goes to school in Boston. He came over to my hotel room before the game and tossed my hat on the bed, which everyone knows is just about the worst luck in the world. Talk about bad mojo. But I don't blame him. The kid just didn't know. Also, most, or maybe all, major league teams now insist on a five-man pitching rotation. And our fifth man, Bronson Arroyo, while promising, is still very much a work in progress. That fifth man in the rotation is about stretching the starting pitching. And that, of course, is all about the money. We've been there before in this book and will undoubtedly be there again. But I can remember a time, children, I believe it was in 1959, when the White Sox went to the World Series with what was essentially a three-man rotation. Of course, those were the days when a good pitcher still got paid in five figures, and a man could take his whole family to the ball yard for $20, parking included, and smoke a white owl in the grandstand if he was so inclined. I'm not saying those were better baseball days, but I'm not saying they weren't either. In the midst of all this, Kevin Youkilis drew a walk in his last at-bat. He still hasn't played in a major league game where he's failed to reach base. A final note before I pack it in for the night. I took myself off this afternoon to see Still We Believe, an entertaining documentary which chronicles the star-crossed Red Sox team of 2003, the one that voyaged so far only to tear out its hull, not to mention the hearts of its fans, on those cruel Yankee reefs in the seventh game of the American League Championship Series. This film is currently playing in theaters all over New England, plus a few New York venues, where it is attended largely by sadists in Yankee caps, one would suppose, and probably nowhere else. It's a charming, funny, sweetly poignant film. It's token efforts to explore the mind of management, always supposing management has a mind. A hypothesis with little evidence to support it aren't very interesting. But when it focuses on the fortunes of four fans, it's a lot more successful. One is a young man who is wheelchair-bound due to an accident. Two are semi-daffy, but very endearing young women I kept thinking of as Laverne and Shirley. The fourth is Angry Bill. Angry Bill is a piece of work, overweight, hypertensive. He suffers persistent nosebleeds during the 03 postseason, full of nervous energy, bursting with cynical pronouncements that barely cover his bruised baseball fan's heart. This guy has lived and died with the Sox for so long, mostly the latter, that he sums up an entire New England mindset when he states, in effect, that the Sox are always going to lose. He knows they're going to pull an El Foldo in August, just as sure as he knows the sun's going to come up over Boston Harbor in the East. And if they don't pull an El Foldo in August, they'll pull a tank job in September, just as sure as the sun's going to go down over Attleboro in the West. And yet, with Boston ahead during the early going of that climactic Game 7 in October of 2003, Angry Bill briefly allows himself to become Hopeful Bill. Because the Red Sox do this to us, too. Every year, at some point, they turn into Lucy holding the football. And against all our best intentions, and our knowing that those who do not learn from history are condemned, fucking condemned to repeat it, we turn into Charlie Brown running once more to kick it, only to have it snatched away again at the last moment, so we land flat on our back screaming, "Og!" at the top of our lungs. And when, after Grady Little leaves Pedro in, long after even the most casual baseball fan knows he is toasty, fried, broiled, baked, cooked to a turn, stick a fork in him, he's done, when the coup de grace is delivered by Aaron Boone long after Pedro has trudged to the shower, Angry Bill stares with a kind of wondering disbelief into the documentarian's camera, at us in the audience, 7 months later, 7 weeks into a new season later, us with our tickets to tonight's shellacking by the Oakland A's in our pockets, and delivers what is for me the absolute capper, the jilted Red Sox fan's final word. "Don't let your kids grow up to be sports fans," Angry Bill advises. And at this point, the movie leaves him, mercifully, to contemplate the Patriots, who will undoubtedly improve matters for his battered psyche by winning the Super Bowl. But I'm sure Angry Bill would admit, if not right out loud then in his heart, that winning the Super Bowl isn't the same as winning the World Series, not even in the same universe as winning the World Series. Meanwhile, the Yankees, the evil empire, our old nemesis, have come from behind to beat Baltimore once again, and our lead in the AL East is down to a mere half game. I'm off to bed, knowing that the boogeyman has inched a little bit closer to the closet door.
May 28th. It's the big holiday weekend. Once the kids get home from school, we've got to drive down to the Rhode Island shore and help my in-laws open up the beach house. So after lunch, I run around town trying to fit in my last errands. I'm at the Stop and Shop when I remember the new Reverse the Curse ice cream, and there it is in the freezer section. The carton is boring and generic. I'd hope for more interesting packaging, maybe a nod to the monster that I could use for a penny bank. Still, the ice cream should be good. We poke along I-95 with all the other Memorial Day traffic. Trudy and her parents have been lifting and cleaning all day and don't feel like cooking, so we go out for dinner. By the time we make it back, the Sox are down 4-1 to Seattle in the fifth. Ichiro's just driven in a run and steals third on Pedro, who has that dull, long-suffering look he gets when things aren't going right. There's only one out, and Edgar Martinez is up. Pedro gets him swinging, then gets the next guy to pop up. In our fifth, Millar and Euclid tag Joel, as if he's from Krypton, Pinheiro, for back-to-back doubles, making it 4-2. See, all the Sox needed was us watching. Pokey K's, but with two gone, Pinheiro walks Johnny and Mark Bellhorn to load them for Big David. On the first pitch, Ortiz lofts a long fly to right. Ichiro goes back sideways and keeps going all the way to the wall where he leaps, He hangs there, folded over the low wall, only his leg showing. We can't see the ball, but the fans behind the bullpen fence are jumping up and down. It's gone, a grand slam, and we're up 6-4. In St. Pete, the Yanks have beaten the D-Rays, so we need to hold on to stay in first. Pedro settles down. In the eighth, he gives way to Embry, who throws a scoreless inning. J.J. Poots comes on for the M's and gives up a smoked single through the middle to Manny. It makes Poots river dance. And then, after a long at-bat, a double to Dauber off the bullpen wall. Bob Melvin decides to walk Tech to set up the double play, which Kapler foils by popping up. Poots goes 2-0 on Euclid and has to come in with a strike. Euclid slaps it down the right field line for a double and two more insurance runs. And the PA plays the corny old Hartford Whalers theme, Brass Bonanza. Fulk closes, but it's a battle. He throws 30 pitches and leaves runners on second and third for an 8-4 final. A tougher game than expected from the last place M's, but El Jefe, Big Poppy, D.O., David as Goliath, brought us back.
May 29th. It's Saturday of Memorial Day weekend, but I've had all of Boston and Fenway Park I can take for a while. 7 games in 8 days is plenty, especially given the uniformly shitty quality of the weather. Footnote: the start of last night's game was held up for an hour and a half in anticipation of rain showers that never came. And that's not all. Hotel living gets creepy after a while, even when you can afford room service. Maybe especially if you can afford room service. Also, my wife headed back to Maine after the Penn dinner on Wednesday, and I miss her. But as I run north under sunshiny, breezy skies, I keep an eye on the dashboard clock, and when 1 p.m. rolls around, I hit the radio seek button until I find the voices of Joe Castiglione and Jerry Trupiano, comfort food for the ear. Listening to a baseball game on the radio may be outmoded in this age of computers and satellite television, but it hath its own particular pleasures. With each inning, you build your own Fenway of the mind from scrap heap memories and pure imagination. Today the wind is playing tricks. Wakefield's knuckleball is staying up in the zone, and the usually lackluster Mariner hitters pounce on it right from the get. In the second inning, a Seattle batter hits a towering fly, foul of first, but the wind pushes it back into fair territory. Mark Bellhorn, today playing second, tries to stay with it, can't. The ball bonks him on the wrist and falls for a double. I see all this quite vividly, along with Manny Ramirez's homer to left, hit so hard it leaves a vapor trail, Troop assures me, as I drive north between Yarmouth and Freeport, with that same wind pushing my own car. Since I can't read a page of my current book between innings, the galley of Chuck Hogan's Prince of Thieves is now tucked away in my green 1999 All-Star Game souvenir carry bag, I punch the CD button after each third out and listen to 2 minutes, timed on my wristwatch, of Larry McMurtry's The Wandering Hill, Volume 2 of the Berry Bender narratives. I have found that 2 minutes gets me back to the game just in time for the first pitch of the next inning. In this fashion, the 240-mile trip to Bangor passes agreeably enough. One wishes the Red Sox could have won, but it's hard to root against Freddy Garcia, a great pitcher who is this year laboring for a bad ball club in the Mariners. And the worst the Sox can do on the current homestand is 6-4. One may reasonably hope for 8-2. One may even hope the hapless Devil Rays will beat the Yankees tonight, and we will retain our half-game hold on the top spot a little longer.
Waiting at home in the mail is the Nomar ball from the Nomar Bowl, a nice souvenir of his lost season. My email inbox is sluggish, filled with pictures of Lisa at the town lanes with Nomar, with Dauber, with David Ortiz, with Mike Timlin, with Alan Embry, even with Danny Ainge. Everyone's smiling, though I don't see any players actually bowling. The Yanks beat the Rays 5-3, so they're in first place. I smother my sorrows in a bowl of Reverse the Curse and read the sports page. My Pirates, amazingly, are at 500, thanks to a pair of walk-off homers to take a twin bill from the Cubs. And it says Nomar's scheduled to start his rehab stint at Pawtucket tomorrow. The best news I could hope for.
9:50 p.m. I take my wife to the Crazy Weather movie, which we both enjoy. I walk the dog as soon as we get back, then hit the TV remote and click on headline news. Weekends, the ticker at the bottom of the screen runs continuous sports scores, and oh shit, the Yankees won again. They've regained the top spot in the AL East, one they've held for almost five consecutive seasons, leaving me to wonder how in the name of Cobb and Williams you pound a stake through this team's heart and make them lie still, or if it's even possible.
May 30th. We've got monster seats and get going early. I'm taking the kids while Trudy's bringing her parents from the shore. The weather's clear, traffic's light on I-84, and a cop stops me for speeding. So the morning, which started so promising, turns bitter even before we hit the Mass Pike. I worry that the feeling will linger and ruin the whole day, but there are enough miles to put it behind us. We hit Lansdowne Street, where the sausage vendors are open early for the family crowd. A woman Trudy's mother's age has a sweatshirt that says, "Folk the Yankees."
I'm sure that Stu was at the ballpark today for what turned out to be an extraordinary game, and probably in the prime real estate of my second row seats next to the Red Sox dugout. But I enjoyed it fine at home in my living room, with my wife close by, propped up on the couch with the computer on her lap and the dog by her side. I've come down with a fairly heavy cold as a result of my week of chilly carousal at Fenway, and there is something especially satisfying, akin to the pleasures of self-pity, I suppose, about watching a baseball game with a box of Kleenex near one hand and the box of Sucrets near the other, coughing and sneezing your way through the innings as the shadows on both the infield and your living room carpet gradually creep longer. This game had a little bit of everything. Curt Schilling flirted with perfection into the sixth. Keith Falk blew his first save of the season, his first blown save in his last 24 attempts, it turns out, when Raul Ibanez hit a dramatic three-run home run, putting the Mariners up 7-5 in the eighth inning. The Red Sox came right back to tie it in the bottom of the eighth. Then in the bottom of the 12th, Sox sub David McCarty crushed a 3-0 fastball to what is the deepest part of the park to give the Red Sox the win. And at the risk of sounding like Angry Bill in Still We Believe, I call the shot. Yeah, me. I'd claim my wife as a witness to this feat of prediction, except she was pretty heavy into the computer solitaire by then, and I doubt like hell she was listening. The Mariners' fourth pitcher of the afternoon, a young man with the unfortunate name of J.J. Poots, entered the game with a reputation for wildness, but was into his third inning of exceptional relief work. He struck out both David Ortiz and Manny Ramirez in the 11th, when the roof fell in. After getting the first out in the 12th, he hit Jason Varitek with a soft breaking pitch. Footnote: in truth, Tech, for some reason only known to himself, Stuart Onan always calls him Tech Money, did not try very hard to avoid this pitch. It was a classic case of taking one for the team if I ever saw one. And as a man who got to watch Don Baylor play, I've seen my share. Enter McCarty, inserted into the lineup mostly as a defensive replacement. The count ran to 3-0. Most batters are taking all the way on such a count. But Terry Francona gives most of his guys the automatic green light on 3-0. I like this strategy as much as I loathe his refusal to bunt runners along in key situations. I said, mostly to the dog, since my wife was paying El Zilcho attention, "Watch this. Poots is going to throw it down the middle, and McCarty is going to send everyone home in time for supper," which is just what happened. And thank God the camera did not linger long on the head-hanging misery of young Mr. J.J. Poots as McCarty went into his home run trot. These are the kind of games you either win or feel really bad about losing, especially at home. I feel badly for Poots, but the bottom line? We won it. And the bonus? The Yankees lost to Tampa Bay, who just barely held on, which means we're back in first place. There are three major milestones in a baseball season: Memorial Day, the 4th of July, and Labor Day. The first of these milestones in the 2004 season comes tomorrow, when we play a makeup game with Baltimore. And for a team with so many quality players on the disabled list, we're doing pretty damn well going into the first turn, especially when we can look forward to two of those, Nomar Garciaparra and Trot Nixon, coming back between Memorial Day and the 4th. A third, Bill Miller, may return to the club between the 4th and Labor Day. That brings us back to Kevin Youkilis, Miller's replacement, who has now begun to attract so much notice that Terry Francona has had to publicly state that no, Youkilis will not be keeping the job at third once Miller's fit and ready to play, no matter how well the GGOW, footnote, Greek god of walks, but you knew that, does between now and the happy day of Miller's return. A piece in the Portland Sunday Telegram today by Kevin Thomas, who knows Youkilis from Youkilis's days with the Portland Sea Dogs, the Bo Sox's AA affiliate, points out that Youkilis's locker is on the far wall of the clubhouse, the traditional place for players who are just up for a cup of coffee in the bigs, as is undoubtedly the case with Andy Dominique, who delivered today's game-tying hit in the bottom of the 8th. Thomas also points to previous Red Sox minor leaguers, such as Wilton Veras, who came up to play third with high hopes, only to fade into obscurity. Obscurity would not seem to be in young Mr. Youkilis's future, however. "I know I'm going to be playing," he told Kevin Thomas in today's interview, speaking with quiet certainty, and with every passing game his on-base percentage seems simultaneously harder to believe for a rookie and less like a fluke. Moved up to the two-hole today, all Youkilis did was go 3-for-5 with 3 runs scored. His batting average is .317, and his OBP is hovering right around .425. The fans know that Bill Miller may have to battle for his old spot back, no matter what Terry Francona has to say on the subject. It sounds like they're booing the kid when he walks to the plate, but the grin on Youkilis's face says he knows better. That sound sweeping around the ballpark like a soft wind is the first syllable of his last name. Uke, Uke, Uke. 2 weeks ago, he was playing AAA ball in Pawtucket. Tomorrow, on Memorial Day, he's going to be playing the Orioles before a packed house for the first-place Boston Red Sox. And I don't want to jinx the kid, but do you know what I think after having watched him in almost all of those games? I think a star is born.
After the McCarty walk-off job, Netman learns from fan services that the Sox have decided to ban his net from Fenway. "Like the speeding ticket, it could taint the day, but I won't let it. I've had a great run with the net, and it was a wild game today. Half a no-hitter topped by a late-inning comeback, and then the tension of extra innings released with McCarty's game-winner. The Yanks lost at the Trop, so we're in first place. Happy birthday, Manny." Hell, I'm better with the glove anyway. May 31st. In response to flooding on the border of Haiti and the Dominican, David Ortiz, Manny, and Pedro are joining with the Sox to collect donations for aid. "I send a check, and while this book won't be out for another 6 months, I'm sure the victims down there will still need the support then. The address is Dominican Relief Effort, Red Sox Foundation, Fenway Park, Boston, Mass., 02215.
Of Boston's 4 established starting pitchers, the other 3 being Pedro Martinez, Tim Wakefield, and Curt Schilling, Derek Lowe has been the most obviously troubled. In his last 3 winning starts, all at home and all shaky, his teammates have been wearing their red jerseys instead of the usual white ones. So it's no surprise that those were the ones they were wearing when they took the field for their makeup game against the Orioles. It was Lowe's best start in weeks, but this time the red tops didn't help. The real problem today wasn't Lowe so much as it was the middle relief. Like most teams in the wretchedly overstocked major leagues, Boston can't boast a lot in that regard. Yes, there's Timlin and Embry, but Francona doesn't like to throw them in when the Sox are down by more than a couple, and both of them have worked a lot lately and needed the day off. So it was the Paw Sox pitching core, mostly, and no way were they equal to the task. The Sox were down 9-0 before you could say, Lansdowne Street. We've played from behind a lot on this homestand, and have come from behind a lot. But not from this far behind, not against Oakland, not against Seattle, and not against Baltimore today. So now, we're off to the West Coast. Nomar's almost ready to come back, always supposing his rehabbed ankle stays rehabbed after some actual game action with the AAA club, where he went 0-for-3 last night. And the first third of the season is over. The biggest surprise, at least to me, has been how quickly, after the initial scramble, the teams align themselves, just as they have in previous years. Pick of the first 50. The Sox taking 6 of 7 from the Bronx Bombers. And in spite of that, we've reached the Memorial Day marker, 51 games into the season, in a dead tie for first with them. Who would have thunk it?
Steve calls and we dissect the game. They came out flat, we agree. But overall so far, Steve says, we're playing way over our heads. Look at these guys who've been getting it done for us. Euclid, McCarty, Bellhorn. Nomar's not too far away, and Trot. Sure, we're headed out west and the Yankees are coming home, but historically we do okay out there. He's more optimistic than I am, a rarity, but he's right too. And yet, after I hang up, I'm still worried about Lowe, whose ERA must be pushing 7, and who hasn't made it out of the 6th inning in over a month.